Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Sullivan. On the program today, a new cabinet. Who's in and who's out? Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will unveil his front bench tomorrow. Who will be demoted? Who will be promoted? What should you be watching for as the power players in the Trudeau government get shuffled? We'll break it down with Bureau Chief Joyce Napier. Then Scott Reed and Lisa Raitt join the press gallery on what's at stake and why this matters to you. Then, reopening Ontario to full capacity, but a warning flag on the horizon. Yes, it is full capacity for Ontario, for all places requiring a proof of vaccination, but why is the province already announcing the rollback dates for vaccine mandates and mask wearing? Is that a mixed message? Ontario's Labour Minister Monty McNaughton joins us on that and on his move to woo workers. Is the right to disconnect becoming a reality? No more work emails at night? We'll find out about that. Plus, Jean Chrétien claims he never heard of abuses at the residential schools when he was the Minister of Indian Affairs and Northern Development, as it used to be called. Check this out.
We were not informed of any abuse at that time, so that was a situation.
Former Prime Minister told me he wasn't informed of any abuses, as you just saw, at residential schools. In a series of interviews, Mr. Chrétien has defended his actions on this file. What's the consequence, though? And is he right? We will put all that to Negun Sinclair to respond to that. That and lots more today on Power Play. Let's get to the players. Well, tomorrow morning, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will unveil his cabinet. This will be his front bench for the new minority parliament. This is Trudeau 3.0, as I like to say. So far, we only know one thing for certain. Chrystia Freeland is keeping her job as both the deputy prime minister and the finance minister. There's one. There could be up to, 39 others. What about the rest of the cabinet? Can the defense minister, Harjit Sajjan, hold his role after facing enormous amounts of criticism for his handling over the misconduct issue in the Canadian Forces? What about the health minister, Patty Hajdu? Does she stay on that file or is she moved? And what about rising stars and new MPs who were elected? The thing about this is no one knows a lot, but we got to know what you're watching for. And we'll be on our special tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern to talk about it with our CTV Bureau Chief, Joyce Napier, who's been working the phones. Now, Joyce, we know they don't leak this stuff, and I know speculating is, for you and I, this is great fun, just the low drinking probably, but what challenges does the Prime Minister set for himself as he builds a cabinet?
Well, as you did say, Evan, the rumor mill is working full time here, on Parliament Hill. Look, a lot of challenges for Justin Trudeau. He needs the gender balance. That's the one he was bragging about in 2015, because it was 2015. So, you know, that's, you know, part of the Trudeau government, a gender-balanced cabinet. Also, you know, other imperatives are geographical, regional. You have to have regional representation. So that is also a big challenge. Plus, do you want to bring in also new faces in cabinet, or else it's going to be same old, same old? So those are the big challenges. Is it going to be a 36 with him, 37-member cabinet, or is he going to add a few more portfolios in there, divide some? For instance, environment. Will environment stay a one-minister portfolio? Will you divide it in two? That's really important. So those are all the considerations. And look, this is his third mandate. Will this be a legacy cabinet as well? And what is it that the Prime Minister wants to do with this cabinet? So tomorrow we'll get all those answers. And obviously, you know, speculation right now and the guessing game is what we're all having fun doing today.
Yeah, I'm going to throw some things out there just because I like to be wrong. And anyone who really knows probably isn't speaking, and the people that don't know speak, but let's go for it anyway. Anita Anand, you and I both have heard that she probably is going to go to defense. That's my bet, but we'll see. I don't know. Harjit Sajjan will remain in cabinet. I don't think he gets demoted, but he's definitely moved. I don't think Patty Hajdu will stay at health. I don't think Carolyn Bennett stays in Indigenous Services. They got to have some new faces. Randy Boisineau is elected in Alberta. He's got to go into cabinet. I mean, there's got to be some of those basics, but, you know, that's you and I spitballing.
Absolutely. And you know what? We're not the only ones spitballing. That's what's happening today. Look, you've got, defeated MP and Minister Bernadette Jordan out east in the Atlantic provinces. Will she be replaced by another woman? Names like Lena Diab. you know, she's a former Nova Scotia cabinet minister, new face-ish, newish on the national scene, not new on the local scene. We can go on and on. Caroline Bennett, right. Is she going to stay in Crown Indigenous or not? Those are all questions. Anita Anand at Defense, that's what we hear. Mark Garneau, will he stay in Foreign Affairs and for how long? Mm. So, you know, that we can go on and on with all the names, but what we hear is that it probably be a bigger cabinet and still a gender balanced cabinet. That's a big challenge for the Prime Minister.
Yeah, and last thing we'll say, Joyce, I'll put it to you. Justin Trudeau's off to COP, the climate summit in Glasgow, which starts in under a week. A lot of speculation on his environment minister, Mr. Wilkinson, Jonathan Wilkinson. What's your take on that? Wouldn't it be weird to boot the guy this week?
Who has been preparing, you know, all this conference. Look, these conferences, the international conference like COP26 that will take place in Scotland, look, it takes months to prepare these things. And there are a lot of pre-summit meetings. So he has become, Jonathan Wilkinson, Canada's environment minister, has become, for the purposes of this big summit, the face of Canada. Would the Prime Minister shuffle him now that he's done all the groundwork and met with all his counterparts? That is unlikely. But then again, look, if we don't know. It sounds unlikely, but we will know tomorrow at around 10:30, 11 o'clock, whether we're right or wrong.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put my fake money down on his stays as the environment minister, so I'm with that. But we'll see, Joyce, because since we're not betting any money, we're just spitballing. Okay, Joyce Napier and I will be involved in that, and Joyce will be back later with any news. Of course, thanks, Joyce, on that. We will have live coverage of the swearing-in ceremony. Joyce will be at Rideau Hall, and I'll be here, the Prime Minister's new cabinet. We are on at 9 a.m. Eastern on CTV News Channel and on ctvnews.ca. We got a great team for you covering this entire day. Okay, open at last. Today, the province of Ontario lifted their COVID capacity limits, meaning that restaurants, gyms, museums, you name it, they can open at full capacity as long as people show a proof of vaccination. And there's more. By the end of January, the Premier of Ontario says he will lift the proof of vaccine mandate guidelines. And by March, everything goes, including mask mandate. So no more masks by the end of March. Do those end dates undermine the push going on now to get more people vaccinated? And meantime, the government's gearing up for an election next year in Ontario, so there's new protections for workers being announced. Today, the Ford government unveiled an omnibus bill on workers' rights, including the right to disconnect. Companies with more than 25 employees will be required to develop a disconnecting from work policy. These new policies aim to create better work-life balance for workers by outlining expectations for email response times and encourage workers to turn on the out-of-office notifications when off the job. Really? Okay. The new labor legislation will also ban the use of non-compete agreements that prevent workers from jumping to rival companies. So after quitting, and they'll introduce licensing requirements for temporary help recruitment agencies. They'll also allow delivery workers to use company washrooms at businesses they deliver and pick up from. But how does this new face of the Ford government square with the old face of the government that was elected by scrapping the $15 minimum wage and guaranteed paid sick days? Let's find out. Joining me now is Ontario's Labour Minister, Monty McNaughton. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir. And I'll get to the Labour business in a minute. But speaking of getting back to work, on Friday, the government announced in Ontario that in January, proof of vaccination requirements will be lifted in all places like restaurants, bars, sports facilities. I guess the question is, now that everything's at full capacity, does announcing the kind of end to some of these restrictions like vaccine mandates essentially give the unvaccinated or the vaccine hesitant an excuse just to hold out?
I don't think so. I mean, we've come so far as a province. I mean, today we're close to 90% of eligible people being vaccinated with one dose and about 84% a double dose. So we're continuing to urge people to get vaccinated, and the people of Ontario have responded really well. So I'm proud that Premier Ford and Minister Elliott laid out a plan and a pathway forward to how we get out of this pandemic. Right.
But you realize that if a lot of folks are still not vaccinated, and you still need a lot of people to get vaccinated, if they already know, look, I guess by January, the proof of vaccination and the vaccine mandate is going to be lifted, and then, again, doesn't it undermine the very effort? You just put in the vaccine mandates a few weeks ago. Now you're saying you kind of won't need them by January. Doesn't it sort of step on your own toe there?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, our track record battling COVID is solid. I mean, we're doing much better here in Ontario than in most Western jurisdictions, including most provinces. So we're going to continue every day to encourage people to get vaccinated. And we've been, you know, having about 30,000 people a day getting vaccinated, which is good.
But, okay, let me just go to masks. The mask mandate and all the rest of the public health and workplace mandates are going to be lifted by March 28th. It seems like an arbitrary date. Masks work. We're going into, as you know, we're going into the winter. You've still got the 12 and unders not vaccinated. You've got the immunocompromised, haven't got their booster shot. You've seen what's happened in Alberta and Saskatchewan. Again, why already announce you're going to lift the mask mandate on that arbitrary date?
Because we're in much better shape than most other provinces and most other jurisdictions. I mean, we're going to begin vaccinating children in the not too distant future, between 5 and 11. We've got a huge uptake in vaccinations. The workplaces have put in extra protocols to keep workplaces safe. So we're in a good spot. But as the Premier said, and we've said all along, we'll continue to protect the health and well-being of the people. And if we need to make changes as we go, we will.
Okay, so just last thing on that. So you're just not worried that the lessons of COVID past, winter, immunocompromised kids, the variants, the kind of snapback that we've seen, you're not worried that putting these kind of arbitrary, it's all over by January, then March, that's not going to cause problems?
We're going to continue to take a measured approach, a controlled approach to battling this pandemic. And again, the people of Ontario have done a great job, but we will ensure that they're protected and their well-being is protected.
I know there's an election coming up, but and let's get to your workplace legislation, because there's a lot on it today. Let me start at the general and go specific, because it seems like there's a rebrand of the Ford government. You and I have spoken about this. Like, I'm just trying, you know, when your government was first elected 3 years ago, you scrapped the minimum wage moving to $15 an hour. You scrapped the right to two guaranteed paid sick days brought in by the Liberal government. You replaced it, I know, with three temporary COVID paid sick days after a month of public pressure. You ended the temporary pandemic top up for frontline workers before the pandemic ended. So why should Ontario workers suddenly trust, these guys now really like workers, when in fact before you'd seem to be going on a totally different direction?
Well, look, actions speak louder than words. We're proposing our legislation that I introduced today, Working for Workers Act, to really bring in more workplace protections for workers, opportunities to have jobs with pensions and benefits. And everything we're doing is going to lead to bigger paychecks. I can tell you, Evan, for the 2.5 years that I've been Minister of Labour Training and Skills Development, I picked a side, and that's to be on the side of workers.
Okay, well, some workers think that you should maybe be on more of their side. The minimum wage earlier this month went up 10 cents in October, 10 cents, $14.35 per hour. Not even, you know, we have record inflation, 4.4%. How does 10 cents help a worker that your government's been championing frontline work? Grocery store clerks, now they're going to get 10 cents. Like, in this inflation, what does that add up to?
Well, look, I can tell you everything we're doing, all the proposals that's in the legislation today will lead to bigger paychecks, more take-home pay for families. I think about the initiative that we have in our legislation to recognize foreign credentials. Only 25% of newcomers in Ontario today are working in their field that they've studied for. That's an injustice to them. We're going to speed up that process so they get into jobs like the skilled trades, for example, where they make six figures and have jobs with pensions and benefits.
Fair point. Credentials is a big thing of the bill you table today. What is this, the right to disconnect? Sounds great, but I get emails 24/7. I'm sure you did. So let's say I get one. What does the right to disconnect mean, and how does it help Ontario get competitive?
Well, everything we're doing is to rebalance the scales coming out of this pandemic. I understand, and I'm the first to admit that work has changed for people. There's been this blur between working and personal time and family time. So what we're doing in this legislation is to ensure that every employer that has 25 or more employees has to post a right to disconnect a policy to really be transparent when workers are expected to respond to emails or phone calls.
Okay, so there's just so much to get through. I know you want to protect rights for more workers. Earlier in the week, or last week rather, I spoke to the head of the Gig Workers United. They're fighting to have gig workers. These are people who deliver for these app companies, let's say Uber Eats, classified as employees so they could have basic minimum wage, safety protection like employment insurance. They are currently classified as independent contractors. They have no protection. They're furious about that. You want to protect workers, they say, change that for the gig workers. What will you do? Will you make that change?
Look, I've been on the record. No Uber driver or food delivery people should be making below minimum wage. We are going to have changes to address this in the time ahead. One of the things that I'm really proud of in our legislation, and it's because we listen to app-based workers, is to ensure that by law, they have access to washrooms in businesses right. that they deliver to or pick up from. So this is a major step. This was actually their number one health and safety concern that they raised with me, and we're addressing it.
Okay, and the washrooms is something they address, but I'm just going to again ask specifically, are you open to having, making sure that those workers are classified as employees and not simply as independent contractors, yes or no?
Every single day, the measures that we're taking are to ensure that people have bigger paychecks and better workplace protections. We'll have more to say. As you know, Evan, throughout the summer, we appointed an expert panel to address and hear from workers in the gig economy, and we're going to address that very soon.
Okay. I mean, this was an omnibus bill, and there's a lot in this one, but that's not in it. One thing that workers... a lot of people want is childcare. It's fiercely expensive in your province. When will your province sign a deal with the federal government, who is offering something close to $30 billion on the table for that? When will Ontario sign that deal? Are you urging your government to do so?
Yeah, it's certainly an important issue. Childcare is expensive. I know under the former Liberal government here in Ontario, it just skyrocketed. Look, I'm a dad of a young daughter, and I know how expensive it is. Minister Lecce and Finance Minister are working closely with the federal government. We're expecting those discussions to continue and to gain momentum when a new federal cabinet is appointed.
All right, and that cabinet comes tomorrow. Labour Minister in Ontario, Monty McNaughton, a big omnibus bill today. I appreciate you joining us, sir. Thank you.
Evan, great to be with you again.
Okay, coming up on the program, former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien made comments on residential schools and has created a big controversy. What did he say about who knew what when about the abuses? Where does it go now? We'll show you those comments he made, and then Nigan St. Clair joins us to weigh in. Stay right here with Power Play. Former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien is suddenly at the forefront of the debate about reconciliation again after a series of comments he made both to me on CTV's Question Period yesterday on the popular Quebec television program Tout le monde en parle. Mr. Chrétien has just published a new book. The book is called My Stories, My Times, Volume 2, and it recounts much of his time not only as Prime Minister but long before, and not only as a child, but of course the time when he was the Minister of what was then called Indian Affairs and Northern Development under Pierre Trudeau between the years 1968 and 1974. In a wide-ranging interview where I discussed everything with Mr. Chrétien, from China to inflation, I also asked him about his view on residential institutions and if he takes any responsibility for that situation. Here's part of his answer.
We had to manage the problem at that time. You know, education was a very important thing for natives. When I became the minister, there was only a dozen, I think, Indian people graduating from university. Thousands and thousands are graduating every year now. Education is the key. And in those days, in the isolated area, that was the system they had.
But they don't regard that as education. They regard it as cultural genocide.
No, but you know, I'm telling you what is the situation. And we were not informed of any abuse at that time. So that was the situation.
So he said to me he was not informed about any abuse at that time. Now, it's important to recall that Mr. Krejci and Mr. Trudeau released something that was then called the White Paper, which proposed abolishing the Indian Act and making sure that all people in Canada, quote, I'll read from it, have full equal participation in the cultural, social, economic, and political life of Canada. This was the cornerstone of Pierre Trudeau's so-called Just Society. And well, today you might know that there's many calls from Indigenous leaders to get rid of the Indian Act. Back then, the plan was viewed as a way to assimilate Indigenous Canadians, strip them of treaties, nation-to-nation agreements, and the unique identity. Famously, the activist and writer Harold Cardinal wrote a book called The Unjust Society, later known as the Red Paper, arguing that the Chrétien-Trudeau program was, quote, a thinly designed program of extermination. Mr. Chrétien and Mr. Trudeau withdrew that paper. As Prime Minister, though, Mr. Chrétien struck the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples in the late 90s. He set out an extensive, set out an extensive 4,000-page, two-decade-long series of recommendations for profound changes and reconciliation. His minister of what was then called Indian Affairs, Jane Stewart, did issue an apology for the residential institutions while he was prime minister. And Mr. Chrétien pointed out that the last residential school closed under his watch. So I asked Mr. Chrétien, in light of recent developments, the recent recovery of the unmarked graves, for example, would he apologize for his role or his government's role in the system at that time? Here's what happened.
No, I'm not the Monday morning quarterback, okay? And I'm not the moderator. Ask me a question about
the book. I wonder, because you just quickly, but has you been asked to apologize for any role in that?
Not that I remember.
And would you apologize?
You know, don't ask me. I didn't. Was not the problem. I were asked other things, but not by the natives on that. My preoccupation was not solving the problem of the past. It's nothing I can do. It was to build the future. And at that time, that was my concentration.
Okay, so that's our interview on Question Period. In his two-parallel interview, Mr. Chrétien drew comparisons to residential schools, to his own experience at a boarding school, saying he had to eat oatmeal and beans. He called the life of the boarding school student very difficult. So what do we make of all these comments and his record on this? Is he simply a man of his times, or does this say something else? I want to bring in the associate professor at the University of Manitoba, Negan St. Clair. Professor St. Clair, always good to have you on the program. You've watched a series of interviews he did. Your reaction to some of the comments from Mr. Chrétien as you kind of refract it through his political career?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this reminds me of trying to deal with people who are in a deep state of denialism when it comes to not just the issue of residential school, but the issue of how did we get here in the first place? How did we get to the point in which we as Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples together are in such a horrible state of affairs? And we have to remember that, it was the Chrétien government that has created many of the emergency situations known as today. When Chrétien was in government with Finance Minister Paul Martin, he instituted the 2% community gap, the funding gap, cap, CAP, that then led to many of the issues around infrastructure, moldy houses, the issue around water. So, you know, when it came to when Paul Martin's time, the Kelowna Accord, which was the attempt to try to deal with the emergency situations that had just been created during the Chrétien years, starting in 1995. So, I mean, many of these situations involving, for instance, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case, which Canada has been found guilty of discriminating against Indigenous children, that situation's created from Chrétien. It's not from Harper. It's not from Justin Trudeau. It's from John Chrétien. And you know, I think in many ways, Mr. Chrétien is trying to play a little bit of a revisionist. He's also trying to get back into relevancy, but is so deeply incompetent, so deeply ignorant. It gives Canadians a small view into what we have been dealing with for decades at the highest offices of Canada, involving just a denial or an outright ignorance involving the issues involving Indigenous peoples. But then, frankly, also shows how that denialism, that ignorance, still continues to try to want to get relevancy in this country.
Okay, let me talk about this. And because I asked him about that, and he said, you know, he was the minister in charge of this file for 6 years. He, you know, obviously Trudeau and the White Paper, which I've explained a bit what it was, tried to get rid of the Indian Act to kind of bring justice. That obviously was pulled. It was backfired. His point, though, was that they dedicated, you know, he's almost a product of the time, that they did everything they could to try to handle what was then the situation. Is this a, I'm not trying to excuse him, I'm trying to understand this as we refract it through 2021, this notion of presentism, judging the past by the standards of the present, is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact is that Jean Chrétien is most like most Canadians in that he has not been educated about residential schools or, frankly, the issues around treaty or the issues around, you know, what reconciliation looks like. I mean, we are in 2021, so we certainly have a broad perspective. And if we think back to the late 1960s, it was full of the civil rights movement, trying to get into, you know, equality, but this real lack of conversation around race. And so, therefore, the leadership, including Pierre Trudeau, was deeply ignorant when it came to issues of racial equity. And, you know, the fact is that Indigenous peoples are not like everybody else in the country, and so therefore have special and unique relationships via the treaties, via our relationships and historical relationships with the Crown and so on. But it does show you that even at the upper echelons, even when Jean Chrétien was in charge of that ministry, there were Indigenous peoples, Harold Cardinal being one you've mentioned, many others, right here in Manitoba, Dave Crashane Sr. and many other Indigenous leaders, because, you know, the National Indian Brotherhood, later the AFN, the Assembly of First Nations, comes out of that moment. So there were hundreds of Indigenous leaders speaking to the government, trying to educate and to say, this is what Indigenous people seek. And the number one thing that we sought was to protect our land claims, to protect our very small amount of rights that Canada had recognized at that point. And getting rid of the Indian Act was not the way to go, because it would create this vacuum where then Indigenous peoples would be swallowed up by the state, swallowed up by the existing poverty, therefore, you know, having to sell this land, which then they would suddenly become private owners of. You can't, throw people into poverty over 100 or so years and then suddenly expect them to then be equal. I mean, you have to have a way in which that moves up. And that's what the red paper, which was the response to the white paper, was proposing. So, you know, it's almost as if Jean Chrétien wasn't listening during those years. And then later, when becoming prime minister, institutes the same old problematic, deeply at times offensive, but also deeply creates more problems than it's worth, government, which then we see today, and here we are in 2021 left to clean up that situation.
Well, I even think, as you say, these debates have been going on so long. Our current Governor General, Mary Simon, of course, was debating Pierre Trudeau on these very issues of rights, as you talked about during the repatriation, long before when Mr. Chrétien was a justice minister there. Negan Sinclair, I really appreciate you giving us your perspective and always taking the time to talk to us, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, Miigwech, thanks so much.
Thank you. That's Negan Sinclair. All right, stay with us. Justin Trudeau's new cabinet will be unveiled tomorrow. Who's getting shuffled? Who's staying put? Which rising stars will get their shot to shine? The Press Gallery digs in next. Stay with us. Cabinet making is always a fun sport here in Ottawa. Who will make Justin Trudeau's cabinet heading into Parliament? The answer will be clear tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. at Rideau Hall, where you start seeing people walk in and you'll say, aha, you're in cabinet. You're not. The Prime Minister reaffirmed his commitment to a gender parity cabinet. That means four new women need to be brought into cabinet, because three lost and one didn't run. Catherine McKenna stepped down. So who will stay in their position? Who shuffled out? What does it mean and why does it matter? Stephanie Levitz is part of our press gallery. She's a parliamentary reporter with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau. Ian Bailey is a reporter with the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau and writes the Globe's daily political briefing. Scott Reed is a CTV political commentator and our special guest and a special person, the former director of communications for Paul Martin. And another special person, former Conservative cabinet minister Lisa Raitt, the vice chair of global investment at banking at CIBC. Wow. This is a good dinner party. So we can either just stop and go out for dinner or actually do this. So let's do this. Steph, I'll go journalist, then special people. Not that the journalists aren't special. Steph, what are you looking for tomorrow?
I think we should just all go out for dinner, because that's all anybody in political Ottawa is talking about, right? Mm. I mean, you already hit on it, Evan. Like, gender parity is going to be a theme that we're definitely going to be looking for. We're looking for how, you know, this is something someone brought up to me today. How do the Liberals manage the fact that their caucus is more urban than it ever was before, and they don't have a great deal of representation in rural Canada? So what newly elected or new voices are going to be brought in from rural communities to speak to that? How is he going to balance more broadly geographic concerns? He's got two MPs in this particular government from Alberta. What kind of roles, if any, does he give them? So there's a lot of bits and pieces. And then, of course, we're also watching for the big thematics. Are we going to see the creation of any new ministries or the end? What about the Minister for Middle Class Prosperity? Are we still going to have that minister? Or are we going to get something new and some shiny new cabinet? So lots of different bits and pieces to watch for tomorrow.
Yeah, well, that was a really, really, really key ministry. Ian, what are you looking for?
Well, you know, there's a school of thought that says that, you know, cabinet ministers don't matter, that the PMO runs everything. But these cabinet ministers are at the forefront of big issues. I'm interested to see who the prime minister puts on big files, harassment in the military, reconciliation, figuring out what to do about China, because these are the folks who are going to have to try and take these files forward before a presumed, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but a presumed election maybe in 2 years. This is still a minority government. And I'm sure the Liberals don't want to go into the next election with some of these big problematic files undealt with. They'll be dealing with new problems then. And there are certain ministers, you know, or prospects, Jenica Atwin, Harjeet Sajjan. I'm interested in seeing where these folks end up.
Okay, let me bring in Scott Reid, because Trudeau 3.0, he's got to he can't do nothing. He's got to put something new on the shelf. What are you looking for? And maybe because you've been involved in planning these things, what considerations would a Trudeau 3.0 be making right now?
Well, a key consideration, obviously, is how do you win the next election? And Ian was hinting at this. I mean, it's got to be your primary motive. Unless we're all agreed that Trudeau is going to retire and he's no longer interested in the grubby, greasy tail of Canadian politics, I think that you have to build a cabinet that tells you, I can win the next election. I can stretch us from minority to majority. I took two runs at it, didn't secure another majority. I want this cabinet to help me win another majority. So what does that mean? Obviously, he has to maintain the gender parity. Obviously, he needs to have safe hands in big portfolios. And he's also got to breathe some new life. He's got to give the caucus members who are now 6 years into being in government, and they realize, hey, man, I need a reason to believe. I got to hope. He's got to give those people a reason to believe and hope. So he's got to put some new blood in there. So I think it's all about whether or not you're going to win the next election. There's really nothing interesting about cabinet making to anyone other than the people who are going to be in cabinet, other than are they going to win the next election?
Yeah, I don't know. Lise, I don't know if you agree with that. Go ahead, Lise.
I agree with some of what Scott says. I think it's going to be a big cabinet. I think that the best way to deal with caucus is by having as many of them in his cabinet as possible. So I'd be looking for the size of it tomorrow. I don't think they care that they're going to be criticized on expense, because there's been a lot of bills lately. So a cabinet bill is just going to be something else to pile in. I think I get to make predictions without being held accountable for them, so I will. I think you're going to see Kamal Khera or Iqraq Khalid out here in the GTA going into cabinet. I hope you get to see Sean Fraser going into the cabinet from Nova Scotia. And the only way to deal with gender parity and getting some folks in who really deserve to get in cabinet after 6 years is by expanding it.
Yeah, governments, as they age, they bloat cabinet because they got to reward people and they don't want to punish people, Steph. But let's get practical here. Harjeet Sajjan is in the hot seat. No one thinks he's going to stay in defense. I think he stays. Does Carolyn Bennett stay in the Indigenous file? Does Patty Haidu stay in health? Like, does he have to shuffle some of the front bench?
He has to shuffle them, you know, because some of them, frankly, may deserve, in fact, to be shuffled. Other, you know, in the need to make way for new faces. And there's also the question, there's lots of folks around Justin Trudeau who've been around him a long time, and for a good reason. They've been loyal soldiers to the Liberal cause. And the question they have to now ask themselves is, you know, to Scott's point, do they want to run in another election? Do they want to still seek out a majority government? Do they want to stay around the cabinet table? Do they want to challenge Trudeau for his job one day? And I think he's going to be going to some of these old timers and saying, listen, what do you want? Because I wouldn't mind if you stepped aside and made way for somebody else. And to what extent people will say yes to that. And, you know, is the best story tonight not who's flying into the Ottawa airport, but who's flying out and going home?
Boy, what a way to argue for your job. We'd like you to step down, Mr. Trudeau. Who do you think is on the hottest seat, Ian? And who's on the hot seat for demotion? Who's on the hot seat for promotion?
For demotion or lateral move, I'm going to take the easy choice. And I would say Mr. Sejan, who has obviously faced some challenges in a file where the Liberals have to get their act together for the sake of victims and for the sake of the military. They need to resolve these issues and move this file forward. So clearly, but Mr. Sejan won well in his riding, so you know he may stay in cabinet, probably will. So obviously he is on the hottest seat at this point. One other thing I'd say as well, Mr. Trudeau may well leave. You know, he may not run in the next election. So this cabinet shuffle may position some members of his cabinet for a leadership run sometime down the road. So that's going to be interesting to watch as well.
Scott, I know pundits always say, oh, he may leave. Politicians don't leave that job willingly. This is a cold, dead hands kind of situation as far as I'm concerned. But you tell me if that's the case, Scott, and who you think has gotten the hot seat for promotion or demotion.
So I think there's going to be an absolute consensus on this. Sejan is obviously in the hot seat. He's got to be moved out of that post. I heard you say a second ago, to my absolute astonishment, Evan, that you thought he would stay in his post. I think you're a madman. Thank God you're not making these choices, because it would be crazy. We cannot have the performance we witnessed and maintain him. It would be such a declaration of arrogance saying, in spite of everything we've seen, we're going to maintain him in the portfolio. They'll move him laterally. They'll try to put together a narrative as to why he, you know, makes sense. They'll off the record acknowledge that he needed to be changed, but what they wanted to do was ease the landing and all that stuff. He's gone. He's got to be gone. And if he isn't gone, it's a hell of a thing to say. The second choice, though, I think in terms of promotion, you know, I'm going to be a bit of a hometown guy here because I'm in the riding of Eglinton Lawrence. I would put Marco Mendicino up the ladder as far as I could put him. And I would do it for a couple of reasons. One, he's an intensely likable guy, liked by all people on all sides. Two, he handled the immigration portfolio through these last 2 years, unbelievably challenging portfolio. I'd put him in charge of infrastructure or something even bigger if I could, because I just think, A, the guy's safe hands, B, he's politically capable, and C, you want somebody from the GTA to be having a big lift other than Chrystia Freeland. And I think it's really important that they send that signal.
Just let me just correct the record. I've always said Sajjan's going to be replaced, but he will stay in cabinet, not in his job, just for the record.
I thought you said he was going to stay in defense. All right, your sanity is replaced. Listen.
I hate to hit you with facts. I know that's troubling. Let me take a break, and I'll come back with Lisa. Look at Scott's giving me the eye. And I'll come back with Lisa. I'll start with you. We'll continue on cabinet. And has Aaron O'Toole got a vaccine problem? Like, why can he not make his mind up on what MP's got to do? So we'll talk about that and more cabinet shuffles coming up next. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program. So, tomorrow, Justin Trudeau will announce his new cabinet, the 3.0. The swearing-in ceremony starts tomorrow morning, and we'll cover that. Meantime, Parliament will get back to work in the buildings behind us in the dark there now, November 22nd. But you got to be double-vaxxed if you're an MP. And Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole still, of course, has not going to... We don't know his position on double-vaxxed. So let's continue our conversation with the press gallery. Stephanie Levitz from the Toronto Star, Ian Bailey from the Globe and Mail, Scott Reed, CTV's political commentator, and Lisa Rader, former Conservative Transport Minister. I promised Lisa that I'd start with you. Lisa, let's get back to cabinet. What are you looking for tomorrow? I think I asked Scott and Ian who's on the hot seat for promotion or demotion. What are you watching for in terms of personnel tomorrow?
I want to see who goes into health, because health is going to be not the role that it was before. It's going to be about negotiating with the provinces for what the provinces view as their number one issue, which is how much more money they're going to get from the federal government in health transfers. So that's going to be a really important one. And I'm going out on a limb, but sure hands wise, I agree with Scott on Marco Mendicino. I'd also say maybe Dominic LeBlanc's back in play for these kind of big portfolios.
Yeah, that's interesting. Scott, you're nodding your head on that?
Yeah, you have to keep in mind that Dominic is a lifelong friend of the prime minister. He's an unbelievably skilled political operator, and he's proven himself very capable in every cabinet position he's ever been given. So if he's at full health, why wouldn't you want him at full throttle?
Yeah, except that you could also make the case that, you know, at Intergovernmental Affairs, excuse me, he's a fixer, and that's what he excels at doing. You can give him any file, and he just goes in and fixes it. So do you need a, you know, do you need a strong performer at health when it's really LeBlanc over Intergovernmental Affairs who can negotiate the health agreements? It's an interesting role he's carved out for himself, and it'll be interesting to see where they continue with him going forward.
I still think Anita Anand goes to defense, Ian. I'm not sure who goes to health. I think Jonathan Wilkinson stays in the environment for COP. I'm not sure who emerges as the new star. Oh, this is great. We can all disagree because none of us know. Ian, anything else you want to think about for tomorrow?
I'm interested in also the in terms of First Nations files, if the Prime Minister sticks with his team on those issues, Ms. Bennett and Mr. Miller, or whether he wants to mix that up, change something around there. That's obviously an important issue, a priority issue, and I'm sure the government wants to get things done on that file again before an election looming in years to come, probably sooner than later.
Okay. I'm just putting my no money on Bennett. Carolyn Bennett leaves that file, but Miller stays
on
that
file. I think
that's a good bet. That's my gut
sense. Yes.
Okay. Lisa, let me go with you. What is going on with Mr. Aaron O'Toole and his party on the vaccine, the double vax? First, he said, we don't accept the Board of Internal Economy's decision that you need to be double vaxxed. Then he said, oh, you know what? We will accept it. Now we don't agree with them, but I'm not sure. Like, what is their position? Do you know?
Nope. I can't tell from what's being communicated. I'm going to be truthful with you. One thing I can say, at least they're having caucus meetings, as opposed to the Liberals who haven't had a caucus meeting yet, to have this kind of discussion that they're having. But they're also having it on the front pages of newspapers. And that is a big problem. I think a communication on a topic as sensitive as vaccines has to be crisp and clear. And right now, the Conservatives are neither crisp nor are they clear in messaging.
This doesn't seem hard, Steph. Like 84% of Canadians have taken a vaccine and they have to show it every time they go to a, you know, like a movie theater. They get asked and the Conservative MPs are still fighting over this. What's your take on this political problem for Aaron O'Toole?
That it's a massive political problem, and it is also not going to go away. I mean, I'm talking to MPs in caucus today who are trying to game this out longer term. And when I say longer term, we're talking next election longer term, Evan. The extent to which this remains a politically divisive issue for the months to come. And as Lisa said, I mean, she said it exactly as it needed to be said, crisp and clear. And if the thing that befuddles the mind at any political watcher is it's not the first time they've fallen down on this particular file, but nor is it the first time that they've struggled with crisp and clear communication since Aaron O'Toole became leader. So at what point do they fix this problem inside caucus and start pulling it together and pulling, you know, you have half of caucus today out on inflation and trying to pummel Trudeau on that. And then you have a bunch of others talking about mandatory vaccination. That is not a cohesive message with which to convince Canadians you are a government in waiting.
Well, one of their stars, Scott Reed, Leslie Lewis, was tweeting about not trusting vaccines for kids. That, I mean, where is this all going, Scott?
Well, it's going to a bad place. I mean, look, Aaron O'Toole has more positions on vaccine mandates than, you know, Ed Rogers has boards. And so this is a problem, and it's not going to go away. And when Steph says it's going to be a problem for the next election, she's exactly right, because I think this is a fundamental problem with the Conservative coalition. You know, there's no fear in that place. They don't fear losing the next election. They don't fear the wrath of their leader. Aaron O'Toole is a toothless tiger. What's he going to say to Leslie Lewis? Shape up or I'm going to punish you? She doesn't care. She just goes on Twitter and says, I won't be silenced. I'm raging for the quiet public. And so you've got an uncontrollable problem. And the challenge is that the next communication we'll hear from a leader of the Conservative Party, like Aaron O'Toole or others, is a ransom note. They are held hostage. They are held hostage to minority elements in their own party, to people and voices who are more afraid of the People's Party than they are concerned about winning Canadian votes. And they're going to end up in a big problem, and it's not going to go away.
Yeah, Ian, your last word on that one. Again, it's
well, you know,
It's one thing to have stuck to a position, but it's another thing to keep changing your position by, you know, every time the sun sets.
Well, yeah, this ambiguity is probably not serving Mr. O'Toole well, and Canadians paying attention to these matters, I think, are going to be kind of distressed. I mean, across society out there, you know, Canadians have to prove vaccination to do things. I went to see a James Bond movie, and I had to go through, you know, clearance and show, you know, I was fully vaccinated and that sort of thing. So, you know, voters are going to look at this and sort of wonder what the big deal is here and why the Conservatives can't come to a consistent position. The only question is how long this goes on, how long this lingers, whether other things arise, whether this kind of ambiguity and uncertainty is a problem for the Tories further down. But I think Scott raises a good point about how this is a problem and a challenge for the Conservatives. And you have all of these positions being conveyed on Twitter from various MPs. It's very challenging for this party, I suspect.
All right, let's just get to what everyone wants to know now. Did you like the James Bond film, Ian?
Yeah.
How could I not? I thought it was a fine film. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, I got 10 seconds. I got 30 seconds. Steph, Dune or Bond? What would you rather see?
Bond. James Bond.
Okay. Lisa?
Bond.
You're two Bond, Dune or Bond? This is so hard for Scott because this is like, I don't know. Dune or Bond, Scott?
I'm a sci-fi nut. I'm going Dune. I want the spices.
Well, you're going to get them tomorrow in the cabinet. We are on our little Arrakis back here on Parliament to find out on cabinet Nerd. Making tomorrow. Stephanie Levitz, Ian Bailey, Scott Reed, and Lisa Raitt, thank you very much. You guys are the 007s of the panel. That is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks for watching. We'll be back in 23 short hours. See you on the special tomorrow. Hug your loved ones. Don't take it for granted.